your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
I have to start with an apology. I announced last week that I'd be speaking about career change at UC Berkeley Extension. Alas, all the seats are now sold out, spoken for, but the good news is they are, as a result, they're going to be making a podcast of that, and I will announce on the show what the link will be for that. But those of you who hope to register, it actually sold out in 4 hours. I would think that only happened to rock stars, but in any case, it happened. A lot of people are wanting to change careers. I guess with the good employment market, people are feeling a little more confident they can afford to make a career change. But in any case, to today's number one topic, career do's and don'ts for parents of college students. A couple of weeks ago, I was honored to be a speaker in a Stanford Distinguished Speaker Series. I was offering advice to parents of Stanford students. And I thought I would share with you a version, an abbreviated version of what I said, but it'll still take about 15 minutes, but I think I decided it's worth your time. Of course, it's applicable not just to parents of college students, let alone Stanford students, but anyone who cares about them. And a lot of the advice, and certainly much of it that I'm going to share with you, that in the edited version I'm going to tell you, is relevant whether you're 17 or 77. Anyway, but I want to start with, how much should parents help? The American societal norm is that after high school, you're supposed to let your kid fly or crash pretty much solo. But at least in my experience, on average, more parental involvement is wise. And you might start a conversation because your kid's going to be expecting you to lay off when they go off to college or is already there in college. But you might start a conversation as a parent by saying something to your kid like, of course, I'm proud of what you've accomplished. And it's right that now you get more autonomy. But for what it's worth, you're only 19, say. Having been on this earth a bit longer than you have, I may still have something to offer you, so I would like to continue being your advisor. I mean, you're now the godfather, but I would welcome remaining a consigliere. What do you think? And then the next thing you got to do is listen really thoughtfully to your kid's response and really listen, and then adjust the extent of your involvement accordingly. Now let's turn to ways that a parent might be helpful to the kid regarding their career. First, let's start with the major, helping the kid choose the major. Contrary to conventional wisdom, it's usually wise to tentatively choose a career early, after only a modest amount of exploration. For example, you might have your child, maybe with you alongside, peruse his or her college's list of majors, then click through to any majors of interest and examine the required courses, the elective courses, and the descriptions of careers that that major could lead to. That simple little thing is more thorough than most kids do, because every college usually has 100 majors or whatever, and it's a fast way to screen all of them, where some kids just, they tend to think, they think of two or three or four, and they just do that, but there are many that are less obvious. Again, one of my themes is always under the radar, and that's a nice way to get to some under-the-radar majors, which could lead to under-the-radar careers, which might not be so competitive to land a job. Now, with regard to choosing a career, a simple, in my judgment, way to do this is to peruse the categorized list of 340 careers and self-employment ideas that are profiled in my new book, Careers for Dummies, and then just read the, you know, half a dozen, two dozen profiles. They're only just like a third of a page long. Read the profiles of any of those careers that are interesting. You might particularly call your kid's attention to, again, under-the-radar careers. For example, I want to give you some examples. Let's say that your child is not particularly technical. Here are some they might consider. Program evaluator. So much of our general domestic product is distributed by grants. And each one of them usually needs an evaluator. It's a fun way to learn a little bit about a lot of careers. On the other end of that continuum, being a grant writer, working for a nonprofit or government, writing a grant to get some of that money. And again, enables you to constantly be involved in innovation. It's really fun. Another example of a nice under-the-radar career for a not-technical person is political campaign manager. A lot of people think about being a politician, But boy, is it interesting to be involved in a political campaign. It's a people management, it's data management, it's the excitement, it's exciting, it's visionary, it's dealing with some unscrupulous behavior on the other part and resisting the temptation for you to do the same. I've been watching a particular race. I'm not going to tell you what it is because, in education, because it's something I know about. And it's dispiriting to see how low these educators who should be high-minded will go. But I digress. If your child is more technical, here are some under-the-radar careers they might consider. Forensic accounting, that is, seeing whether companies are stealing from another or employees are stealing from the company and so on. Forensic accounting. Or researching the biological basis of reasoning skills. Reasoning is prerequisite to so much success, especially in our information economy. Being an orthodontist, a lot of people think about being a dentist, but an orthodontist is an unusually rewarding career and quite lucrative. Or if, you know, so many people who are technical want to develop apps, well, there are some areas that really could use some great apps. One, an app to improve your memory for normal people or people with Alzheimer's. Or better apps for reducing anxiety. We live in the anxiety era. And there are certainly mindfulness and other kind of anxiety-reducing apps, but they have their limitations. So developing better ones would have tremendous applicability. Or an app that would improve the quality of matches on dating websites. A number of my clients, for example, will use Tinder, or they'll use OkCupid, or Coffee Meets Bagel, or OldMatch.com, or JDate. And they're really quite limited in terms of the matching paradigms. It would seem like there really is an opportunity to do a really rigorous analysis of what makes a match really work. And I want to share some other future-resistant careers. And when I call future-resistant, these are careers that are unlikely to be automated or offshored. The aforementioned politician, not political campaign, maybe a politician, they ain't offshoring that. Being a nurse, I'm less sanguine about being an MD, because I really do believe we will have single payer within a few years. And because of that, if we're trying to cover everybody paid for by taxpayer dollars, most of the work is going to have to be done by less costly practitioners than MDs. And so I think the market for nurses is going to be huge, and the range of things they'll be able to do so they're not just under the thumb of a doctor will be enormous. I also think some other future resistant careers will be being a manager who specializes in remote workforces. There is so much work that is going to be done offshore. And somebody who can manage culturally diverse and geographically diverse workers and motivate them, I think, will be invaluable. I also think any field, especially in management, related to genomics and to cybersecurity and biosecurity will be in great demand. Large equipment repair. You can't offshore the repair of an MRI machine to India. If you're a hands-on kind of person, large equipment repair. And I'm just talking about medical. You know, there are these printing presses, including 3D printing presses. MIT has already built houses out of 3D printed walls. So I really think, and you know, that there will be high maintenance required for these printing presses because there's so much liquid being spewed out. Those jets are going to get clogged, etc. So being somebody who can do large equipment repair will be in demand. I also think we're ever more graphically oriented. So I think graphic design careers, but not just pure artist types, but graphic design people who have business expertise, who will know what of their pretty graphics are actually going to result in people either buying more or donating more to the nonprofit or whatever. I think big ticket sales will be relatively future-proof. I'm talking about everything from skyscrapers to airplane leases. And also judges and hearing officers, though they are not going to get offshored, very rewarding, and a whole panoply of consultants, counselors, and coaches. So those are some future-resistant careers that, as a parent, if you are working with your child to encourage your child to consider under-the-radar careers, I think that's a strong idea. Now, there's so many people who say we might view askance to what I've just said there because they think that it's a mistake to specialize early. I understand that remaining a generalist is comforting, but often it is worth committing to becoming excellent in one narrow area. Not only is that going to make you in demand, You're going to gain confidence from knowing that narrow area cold. And if you're tired of it, it's often easier to branch out and be successful in a new niche because you've developed a reputation in your first niche. For example, let's say your kid's a physics or a chemistry major and decides to become expert in, has watched a lot of CSI, expert in, you know, blood splatter or, you know, accident debris splatter, but then after a while gets bored with it. He or she can invoke that expertise to move to some other example of fluid mechanics. Fluid mechanics is the physics underpinning of splatter analysis. For example, they might be able to move into rocketry or biomedical blood flow drugs or blood flow devices or blood flow instrumentation or blood flow analytics. Another way a parent can be helpful in helping the child choose a career is to simplify it. It's remarkably simple and yet better than what most people do to simply Google search a prospective career. Let's say you've looked at the quarter page or third page profile of a career in my book, Careers for Dummies. The next step normally might be to Google search it. For example, let's say field seismology careers, and then check out the top result articles and YouTube videos. It's amazing what a good job Google does of curation, so those top listings disproportionately tend to be valuable. Your child might also hang out on an online forum for people in that career to get a sense of what people are really talking about, thinking about, and the issues are in that field. It can really help a kid determine whether this feels like my peeps or is it really not for them. Your child might consider attending a meeting of a professional association for a prospective career, even just a local chapter meeting, because you're going to learn, you're going to get to talk to a number of people. And learning about a career, you know, using those methods I just talked about is going to be, in general, a lot more valuable than trying to get the classic oft-recommended informational interview. Because even if you can garner one, and that's getting ever harder these days, you're only getting one person's perspective, which by definition is idiosyncratic. And beyond that moderate level of career exploration, which can, I think you can sense, can be done relatively quickly, I have found over the years, and I'm a career counselor, so I'm kind of talking my way out of getting clients, but really, I found that in general, additional exploration beyond that rarely yields sufficient additional valid clarity to justify deferring the choice of career and major. Again, tentative choice of major and career. Of course, your kid may end up changing majors or careers, but even so, that's going to usually be a more informed choice than if they continue to dabble. It's like the sailor who'd like to get from San Francisco to Hawaii. Sure, reasonable planning is wise, but after that, it's wise to set sail and then adjust based on the winds. And another way a parent could be helpful with a career and in choosing a career is to help you decide whether to start a business. We all know lots of businesses go out of business quickly. Well, but a way to boost the odds of self-employment success is to start, and again, I'm using the word again and again, under the radar, but here's a new word, low-status business. If it's a low-status business, that ensures that the competition in that business is going to be weaker, right? If you go into biotech, you go into high-tech, you go into those kind of fields, the competition is going to be really rigorous. But here are a few examples of under-the-radar ones that don't get as much competition. Developing no-button, you know, Velcro-closed shirts that you don't need to button, they're just closed with Velcro. That's going to create a cleaner line and be faster. And now it's especially useful for people who have disabled hands, but it's also, people are busy. You spend a day, an hour, a minute every day putting on a shirt. And if you can do that in 5 seconds and I get a cleaner line, who knows? Could be a way to make a lot of money in starting a business. Hospital, while I'm in the clothing realm, patient wear. When you go to the hospital, you know what those gowns look like. They're ugly, those blue and white little stripe, little dots or whatever. How about it? There's no reason they shouldn't be able to be attractive. Or back to the app world, a little business where you're starting a therapy match. Like it's like Match.com, but for therapists, like whether they're psychotherapists or massage therapists, you know, each one of the therapists who would be curated from having like great Yelp reviews would be invited to come and put a little 1 minute video on your website and their schedule. And then people can review a number of those kind of therapists and click through and make an appointment, and you, who's created this website, gets a little piece of the action. Another example of an under-the-radar business is a seasonal pushcart. I mean, like now, right now, before Halloween. This is the logical extension of the pop-up shop, but with no rent. you know, a little cart that's selling great Halloween stuff, costs very little and might be a great way to make money. And after, of course, after Halloween, you can be doing Thanksgiving stuff. You can be doing, you know, little turkeys you're going to hang around, decorate your house with, or your Christmas stuff, or Hanukkah stuff, or whatever, winter solstice stuff. And there's a tendency for people to, again, be sucked in by the lack of, by status. Don't be fooled by these businesses that I'm describing seemingly being simple. Being good at implementing them does require a good brain and stick-to-itiveness. For example, no matter how simple the business, you've got to develop the product or source the product. You got to price it right. You got to buy it right. You have to manage the project. This is all one big project, developing these businesses. Got to manage people well. Got to manage logistics, getting delivery, inventory. You've got to manage your risk. You got a tax plan. I mean, none of that is for the faint of mind or faint of spirit. And as a parent, you might facilitate a discussion with your child about the wisdom of whether he or she should try self-employment. And, you know, one person doesn't necessarily have to do it all. Maybe your kid could team up with a fellow student, or with you, or a friend of yours, or a relative. Okay, now I want to turn, first of all, let our listeners know, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. The topic one today is career do's and don'ts for parents of college students. A couple of weeks ago, I was honored to be a speaker in Stanford's Distinguished Speaker Series, and my topic was offering advice to parents of Stanford students. And so I'm sharing with you an abbreviated version of what I shared with them. I thought it might be useful to you, whether you have a college-age child yourself. A lot of it is also relevant whether you're, you know, to anybody of any age. So, but now I want to turn it. I've talked now about ways a parent might be helpful in choosing a major career. Now I want to turn to opening doors. So at some point, your kid would have picked out a tentative career or self-employment direction, even if it's maybe just narrow to, say, a career that requires both quantitative and people skills. Well, at that point, maybe the most important thing you as a parent can do is to open doors. You got to let the relevant friends and family know that your child is looking for an internship, job, mentoring. For example, here's how you might word it. My Janie is finishing her sophomore year and is intrigued by the idea of a career in which she'll eventually get to be a leader of a biotech company. She's done well in her science courses and already has become president of her college's biology majors club. Might you know somebody who might be able to offer her an internship or a job, maybe even just some insider advice? Now, to be honest, generally, even if you've reached out to 10 people like that, chances are good none of them are going to have a lead for Janie. The key is in how you respond. You might try something like, I understand you don't have any leads now for her, but would you mind keeping your ears open? And if you hear anything, letting me know. And if in a few months, Janie, Johnny, whatever, is still looking, would you mind if I phone back to follow up? Now, most of those 10, or all of them, are going to agree to that. I mean, they're not going to likely to beat the bushes on behalf of your kid, but the odds are decent, at least, that within those few months, one or more of them will have some lead for your child. Next, I want to, you know, when I talk to the Stanford parents, a lot of them are in a position to hire their kid. Should you? Very often, a parent is in a position to offer their new graduate a better career-launching job than your kid could get in the open market. And if that's true, yeah, it's okay, in my judgment, for you to hire your child, but you really have to treat him or her no better than your other employees. That's going to avoid the other employees being disgruntled, and it's going to avoid your kid feeling that he or she is not earning their keep. Couple more things, and then I want to go to the phones. I want to talk about interview preparation. Let's say your child lands an interview for an internship or a job, or even just for information. You as a parent can help in preparing. Let's say, for example, you could help your child develop a 30-second summary of him or herself and the tentative career goals. Let me try to come up with an example. While I'm a poetry major, I don't expect to make a living at that, but I do enjoy using the written word and the spoken word, and I hope to eventually rise to be some kind of a leader in a good company or a nonprofit's communication department, or maybe for a quality journalistic publication or radio or TV or podcasting entity, whatever. And I would welcome any advice you might have. So you see, I kind of said all that in maybe 45 seconds. It's also useful as a parent to try to get your child to have a few PAR stories ready to tell. PARS is an acronym. It stands for problem, a problem your child faced, the cleverer, dogged approach that she took toward solving it, and the positive result. And the best are like stories that would impress that target employer. And each should be told in less than a minute. Let me come up with one, for example. When I started the campus libertarian chapter, protesters tried to shut us down. They yelled that libertarianism is insensitive to the poor and to people of color. I tried to remain calm, and I made the case for why libertarian policies may at least, no guarantees, but may be best for all people. Because I was statesmanlike, the protests faded, and the organization was allowed to continue. So that's a par story. That was the problem, that she got tried to get shut down in starting a chapter of a political organization. The approach that she took, very statesmanlike, and the positive result is that the protests diminished. By the way, while we're on interviews, another useful interview technique is when you get asked a question whose answer you could diagram, you might ask if you can go to the whiteboard to show how you would structure your approach to the problem. That's very memorable. It's assertive without being obnoxious, and it makes your explanation clearer. And also, you, as you're writing it, you can be clarifying your own thoughts about the complex problem. Next, I want to turn to what a parent can do to encourage their child to make the most of an internship. Your kid has worked hard, already gotten the internship. Now, what I'm going to say now may seem obvious, because I've seen even some top students fail at this, it can't hurt for me to remind your child, for you to remind your child, that your kid should treat even an unpaid internship as an audition for a job. And an example may help here. I was on a Today show, and in addition to the director and camera people, it was a very large studio, almost as big as a football field, and it was filled with 24 20 to 22-year-old, I guess, around that, women. Yeah, and they were all women. I'll leave to another day why that is and whether that's good or bad. But anyway, most of them were chatting with each other. But one of the women was striding from guest to guest, from the camera person to the director and to the hosts, clearly trying to be helpful to every one of them. Well, when my segment was over, I walked over to her, and I told her that I was impressed with her industriousness. And she said, you know, funny you should say that. Our summer internships are just about over, and I was the only one of the 23 to be offered a job after graduation as a producer. So your kid, all students, have got to think of their internship as an audition. Unfortunately, it's an audition in which only a small percentage of the auditioners get cast. You might want to also talk to your kid a little bit about particular extracurriculars that are career-related. Remember, my talk is about career do's and don'ts for parents of college students. You might encourage extracurriculars that are going to yield professional growth and personal growth. Here are a few examples you might want to explore with your kid. To start a club or an activist group, or create content for a campus newspaper, radio station, TV station, or website. Encourage your kid to consider being a student member of the faculty senate or the student government. And again, depending on your kid's preference, you know, it's perfectly appropriate to sprinkle their life with pure de-stressors. You know, I remember when I was in graduate school at Berkeley, I went to lots of college basketball games and football games, and I even joined the campus's intramural bowling league. So, you know, there's just time sometimes to veg out, especially when you're in college. It's not all about career and work, but since my topic was about helping your child with career, that was my main focus. But I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about the value of fun any time in your life, but especially when you're in college. But speaking of fun, I need to say, and I did say this at Stanford to the parents, I don't know how they felt about it, but I felt I needed to say a word about drugs. The legalization of marijuana has created certainly a second alcohol, or worse. According to the recent meta-evaluation by the National Academy of Sciences of the 100 most rigorous studies of marijuana's effects, this is not right-wing political reefer madness crap. As a result of that meta-evaluation of the 100 most rigorous studies of marijuana's effects, its effects on mental health and physical health, and in turn which affects career and personal life, are much greater than the often big tobacco-funded weed advocates would have us believe. Now, I know that discussing that can be tough with your kid, either because your kid knows that maybe you're a user, or because if your kid is a user, it can make the kid very defensive. So my best shot at it as generic advice is that you show your kid that summary. There's a summary section of that meta-evaluation. Just Google it. Meta-evaluation, National Academy of Sciences, marijuana, you'll find it. and show them the summary, and then simply ask, what do you think? And then try, maybe, usually, let it go unless you're really worried. Of course, you can have a similar discussion about alcohol or stronger substances. And finally, is where I ended my talk at Stanford, is I told people that I've had the privilege of having been career and personal coach to 5,500 people, including some of the most successful people on earth, as well as some real strugglers. And while intelligence and drive are the number one and number two differentiating factors, number three is that successful ones are more likely to follow my Holocaust survivor dad's advice. When I asked him why he so rarely talked about the Holocaust, he said, Martin, the Nazis took 5 years from my life. I won't give them 1 minute more. He said, Martin, stop looking back. Always take the next step forward. And that's how I ended my talk to the Stanford parents. I like to think that maybe it was worth the 25 minutes I've just spent sharing that abbreviated version with you. But now I'd like to go to the phones. If you especially are the parent or somebody, if you've got a college kid in your life, somebody you care about, and you would like to ask a question about their future career, their existing, if they're, you know, their existing work, anything related to career for a college student or graduate school student on how to help them launch their career better or already readjust, that's particularly of value. Of course, if you've got any career question, I'm pleased to answer it. But the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko for that, and I call them workovers, is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And as well, if you have any comments, you know, like I did, of course, a Q&A at my at Stanford talk, and there were lots of good questions. If you've got a question about what I've said or a comment, that's also welcome. The phone number again here at KALW and Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. Those of you who are regular listeners to the show know that I believe in tweeting. Since 2009, I have posted 5,116 tweets as of today. And the reason I like doing it is because they archive my best ideas. And periodically on this show, I share what I think are the best and most relevant to career. And I'm going to share the best of the current crop. But as usual, my priority is you, my dear listeners. So I'll give out the phone number and then go right to the phones. If you have a question about your career, especially if you have a question about a college student or graduate school student who you care about, who's in your life, or you're one, of course, if you're a college or graduate student, anything related to your career, directly or indirectly, is fair game. The phone number, 415-841-4134. What's that the number for? It's the number for what I call a work over here at KALW and this show, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. And now to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Hello. My name is Benjamin. I have a daughter who just started college in high school. She was studying theater tech, mostly costuming. Mm-hmm. Now she's thinking about becoming an archivist and listening to your discussion of future-proof jobs. I kind of think that will work as kind of a future-proof position, but maybe you could share your opinions there.
I am agnostic. One of my axioms is that any job where the work product can be sent over the internet will be sent to low-cost countries. And there is no, especially as ever more information, ever more of what used to be, you know, printed documents, or, you know, used to be microfiche locally. You know, so much is digitized now. And the
archivist, sure, that does include some things that are just like straight paper, but there's other things that you might find in an archive that kind of borderline art objects and things like that, or in the case of my father, who works at a museum, where he's dealing with actual artifacts that are not really display quality, but are there for research purposes.
Much of that, again, can get digitized. So if I am running a museum, and let's say here in San Francisco, I'm at MoMA, and the cost of hiring an archivist in America might be $80,000 a year, plus benefits, rights of termination, et cetera, et cetera. and I can get a low-level intern to digitize all of those objets d'art, and for categorization, creating systems for record keeping. Certainly some of it. Of course, some of it has to be done locally. I understand that. But I worry that a too large a percentage could be digitized and offshored. So I'm more nervous about that than a career that cannot, as I mentioned, things like program evaluation, politician, medical equipment repair. That said, I like it, of course, because it's under the radar. A relatively small percentage of people want to do archival work, but a million people love to work in museums. So that's why I say I'm agnostic.
Okay. That's interesting and useful perspective. Do you think that there's anything that is more future-proof that would kind of be similar in scope?
It is my view that museums are a little atavistic, notwithstanding your father's lifetime career in it. I'm seeing a relatively, as the technologies for virtual experiences grow, holographically, not just VR headsets, which are today, but I happen to know that there are entities, companies that are working on creating truly, truly immersive environments that are where you can interact with the environment, not just observe it. And so I worry that museums are not going to be the locus, the platform for which there will be many jobs. But for somebody who is, now I noted with interest, she's clearly detail-oriented. She wouldn't want to be a costumer. You'd mentioned at the front of this talk that she was interested in, she had done costuming work in high school. And her interest in archiving is clearly detail-orientedness. In my judgment, the area in which detail-orientedness is going to be invaluable is in deep learning, artificial intelligence, machine learning. There's going to be a lot of people who are going to be doing various things to data sets to clean them up, categorize them, etc. And while the final product, the lower-level work, might end up being offshore because, again, it's digital, but some of the earlier work, which requires cultural competency to understand, for example, how to interpret Facebook data or nonprofit fundraising data, requires a cultural competence that's going to be difficult to offshore. So if you ask me for something that is more applicable to a detail-oriented person that might be more consistent with the direction the future is going and be more offshore-proof, that would be my first guess.
Okay, I'll consider that. Thank you for your advice.
I more importantly let her consider that, or not consider it, at least consider it and then reject it. Too often, you know, we deeply involved parents can be a little helicoptery. So when you said, I'll consider that, and you're talking about your daughter, make sure it's a we at least.
Well, I'll consider that in the sense that I'll see how I can suggest something down that line to her, because I don't think that's exactly what would fit best for her, but
let's try something else. I'm eager to be of help. So tell me what feels wrong with that. Because that may enable me to make a better suggestion.
She's relatively strong with math, but I don't think she would be, from what I know about the computer learning, that is an extremely math intensive field. Culturally categorizing things, I don't have as much confidence as you that that's going to be as useful a field. I think that can be largely offshored. She's better at math than in her word skills, so I don't think she's going to be so great at doing things like writing grants or reviewing grants.
Mm-hmm.
So
let me take another shot, given her costuming thing. In every field there's a hierarchy. Clearly the people who are developing what they call, it's a paradoxical term, but the lower level, the really foundational aspects of deep learning are going to be PhD types who are extraordinarily multidimensional math, topology and multiple linear levels of multiple regression, but that's where it starts or where it ends. But somewhere in there, let's take the world of fashion, given that she's interested in costumes. there is going to be people who work with the really deep techies to determine what the right categories are. And where, and in the gray areas, where does this data point fit in? So I'm not saying she needs to be a super mathematician, but the intersection, for example, of her interest in costuming, therefore slash fashion, whether it be current or old, with her detail-orientedness that would have made her attracted to archival work, and the clear vector that is the society is moving toward big data being perhaps the most central, and artificial intelligence being the most central direction that one could, that is almost unanimity that that's where the jobs are headed. That leads me to suggest that maybe she could work at the intersection of fashion, big data, and detail orientedness.
Yeah. Okay. That sounds like a good direction to suggest to her. I think that some of the categorization work is just stuff that Amazon Mechanical Turk is just going to provide the work there, that people are not really going to have careers in that. It's just going to be somebody in their spare time.
This is a good discussion.
Things.
At the lowest level, once the categories have been selected, then they can give it to Mechanical Turk. That's an Amazon subset that where they hire people by piecework all over the world for very little money to just put things in categories. But the people who will create the categories need to have a real deep understanding of the variables that could be included in the paradigm for the fashion thing. And so I'm not saying that's the only thing, but, given this radio conversation, I'm trying to amalgamate the pieces of information you're giving me. Give me one more piece of information about her that may enable me to make one better guess.
She's kind of visual. She's been working on making self-published zines and things like that, where it's mostly a collage of old objects.
Okay, that's pure art. But there, as I had mentioned earlier, one of the dozen or so careers I outlined is going to be there will continue, as society seems to be ever more aimed toward visual, whether it be still visual or short videos, there is going to be a need for people who are graphic design but also have a sense either of business or nonprofit business. That is what will raise money. Because anybody can put, not anybody, but an artistic person can create, found objects and make them look cool, but that's a hobby, for 99.99999% of people.
Yeah, yeah.
And
right.
So, yeah. But the ability to do graphic design work using, the basic tools of Photoshop and Illustrator, but in very clever ways that nonetheless would move the hearts and minds of potential customers or donors to a nonprofit, might be a way that a visual person might end up making a living. Does with their aesthetic sense? Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, and I think that just the collage work she's done in her spare time, I can kind of see how that sort of thing gets used in magazine illustrations where they just want to illustrate an article and they just have a collage of clip art that they use.
Mm-hmm.
I can see that there's a very similar thing going on there.
I worry about that being the same thing you worried about
the mechanical Turk,
being low pay, moving some pretty objects into a collage. Doesn't sound like a sustainable middle class living. That's why I'm a little worried about that. That's why I wanted to merge.
I would agree there, but I just see how it does exist.
All right. Well, I wanted to give you a little more space if you needed it, but I'm going to thank you for the call. We've got other lines lighted up. We'll go to the phone. Thanks. I did my best.
All right. Thank you.
You take care. Bye-bye. I'll give out the phone number again. If, as you see, I'm willing to be a pit bull. I keep trying. I'll try my very consistent with what's realistic on a radio show. I will do my very best to help you. You can count on that. If you have a work-related problem, and especially the topic I spent the first 25 minutes in the show talking about is career advice for parents in helping their kid who's in college or graduate school, especially if you're somebody, parent, grandparent, guardian, just friend, care about somebody who is in college or graduate school and could use some career help, I'd like to provide it for you. The phone number is here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I promised before that I was going to talk about some tweets that I recent tweets on work, but I want to prioritize you. So let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Yes, sir. How do you do? My name is Kenneth Marlow. I'm an award-winning author. I'm a writer, and I own a company called Trichome Technology.
But right now, I'm hearing a little echoing. Have you turned down your radio?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. Please go ahead. So you're an award-winning writer. The rest kind of was echoey. Can you please repeat that?
I'm an award-winning writer and author and the owner of a company called Trichome Technologies.
Okay.
I'm a columnist for a magazine called Cannabis Business Times.
I see.
And I take great umbrage in your advice and your comment regarding big tobacco and cannabis. In the middle of an opioid epidemic, I don't think that the younger generation needs to have you tell them not to do cannabis. Cannabis is set and ready to be probably the next tech industry, a multi-billion dollar industry. Multiple states, multiple countries have legalized.
And I'm going to interrupt you because it's off topic for the show. The show is about careers. I'm not going to hear we're not going to get in a debate about cannabis. Thank you for the callers. All the lines are lighted up. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Okay. Is that my on the air?
It is you. Hello.
Hi. Okay. So I have a son at San Diego State taking civil engineering.
Okay.
And I was wondering if there's a future in that, or is that going to go by the wayside? With computers or whatever.
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's good, you know, for example, some areas that civil engineers will likely to be continue to be useful for. Civil engineers are normally used on very major construction projects. And I really do think that it's clear, you know, given the, you know, maybe it's because I sit in gridlock to get, takes me over an hour to get here, the 10 miles from my home in Oakland to the studio. No, and we're not building more freeways, but there's clearly going to be a commitment to more mass transit because this is just untenable. People can't move. People can't go anywhere. They can't get to work. They can't see their friends. They can't do anything. Right. So I believe that a civil engineer who specializes in a vector, a vector is a direction, a vector that is clearly where society is headed, especially here in the Bay Area and California more broadly, will do fine. But that's where I talk about early specialization. I don't think there's anything wrong with civil engineering, but I would, rather than think about civil engineers, you know, building, you know, more bridges, more roads, more buildings, I would try to focus, specialize early. He or she can always change if it doesn't work, but I would start by trying in his or her field work, in their term papers, in their projects, whatever, to, for example, specialize in mass transit, you know, light rail or whatever. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Great. All right. Thanks a lot. Cool.
You can maybe talk with a counselor and just see where to go, you know, what's a vector and like you say.
Well, so what, you know, of course, every kid, as I mentioned earlier, every kid who's interested in, say, in a field, let's say civil engineering, should simply start by, on your kids' college website, there is going to be a section for civil engineering, and there's going to be usually a section that says careers that civil engineers can do. But that's the starting place. But then after that, there's no reason why he or she shouldn't simply put in quotes civil engineering and then careers, and you will, in the first Google search results, you will find both text and videos that are going to expose him or her to a wide range of options that go well beyond what he might have thought of. Does that make sense?
Good. Excellent. Thanks so much.
You're That's welcome. Helpful. Back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. Marty, I'm a regular listener.
And, thank you.
I've been kind of reluctant to call for a while now because I'm a little bit afraid of what you might say.
Okay. I'll try to be nice. But I'll be honest. One thing I have to do is be honest.
Well,
I'll say it nicely.
You're a straight shooter, and I appreciate that. I don't always agree with what you say, but I think you're really... I appreciate your honesty.
I do try.
Here's the situation. I'll be 50 in a few months.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at a career change,
mm-hmm.
And I'm realizing it's a lateral move, and financially... Being completely honest, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Okay.
But it's something that I find rewarding, and I'm getting a lot of encouragement on, and it feels like it could be very gratifying.
Be specific. Tell me what you're doing now, and tell me what you're trying to transition to.
I work as an interpreter. Uh-huh. I've been working as an interpreter for almost 20 years now.
Foreign language, sign language, what kind of interpreter?
Court interpreting.
Corporate interpreter. Okay, great. Go ahead.
Yeah, so, it's given me, pension, some security to the degree that any job is secure these days.
Right.
And the practical thing for me to do would be to, finish out my time with, my court service and retire. That's not entirely satisfying to me. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in speech pathology. Mm-hmm. I went back and I got a second degree in speech pathology. I'm looking at grad school.
Mm.
The reality is that going back to grad school means going without an income for 3 years. There's an opportunity cost to that.
Yep.
And once I'm done with that, even in the best case scenario, I am looking at not increasing my earning potential over what I'm currently perceiving.
Decreasing it, perhaps, yeah. And you're a 54-year-old newbie speech therapist competing with people in their 20s and 30s, and much as we don't like to admit it, it's not three strikes against you, but being a newbie at 54 is one strike against you.
Well, I should say that I mean, this, when I was looking at what other things I might do, it does feel like this is a field where my age might not count against me, but it might be an asset.
If you're dealing with there are speech therapists who work with stroke patients and older people for whom your age
I'm
might
doing
be a
rehab
plus.
Hour. I'm doing volunteer hours in the rehab center. It's great. I really like the population.
Okay.
It's indigent care. It feels right.
Okay.
On that kind of social, kind of personal level.
Have you done a thorough enough search to find if there are programs you could do, depending upon your economic situation, how much that opportunity cost of lost income during those 3 years? Are there part-time, night, or weekend, or what are called asynchronous programs that can be done 24/7? You could do them in your pajamas at the midnight. Have you done a thorough enough search about whether at least partial?
Yeah, and they're really not the strongest programs, and it's going to be pretty much a full-time commitment for 3 years that will leave very little limited opportunity for outside work.
How are you defining strongest? Not that you say they're not the strongest programs. Define that for me, because that could mean different things.
I question the academic rigor of some of the programs. I think at the undergrad level, perhaps there would be good online programs available. That I would pursue that if I were in that position. But for the graduate work, it doesn't really seem to me that, particularly with this kind of work, where so much of it is about rapport building and working directly with clients, I think it really needs to be in person.
In my attempt to add value, I'm going to at least invite you to not dismiss those so quickly. As somebody very familiar with, quote, rigorous programs, rigor is not necessarily defined by practical utility. That ability, if you say, and you're correct, so much of what working with any patient is, or any client, is understanding their psychology, getting them unstuck, getting them motivated. That is something that is more likely to be taught well by a master practitioner than by somebody who would be a faculty member at a, quote, rigorous university at a Berkeley or a San Francisco State, where there is, where research and theoretical work is so central to their hiring and promotion. Some of these no-name places might indeed have master practitioners, places that have crappy, that don't, like National University, sounds terrible, right? But National University very often will hire, and I don't even know if they have a program in speech pathology, but they have, they hire master practitioners who may be better for training you on how to develop that rapport and the day in the ins and outs than Professor Hassenpfeffer. Am I missing something here?
No. I think you might be right, generally speaking. But I think, with speech in particular, I don't doubt that some of the programs might have great faculty. But I don't think that I'm going to get what I'm looking for.
Okay,
because
one more push
what
at
I'm
it.
Looking for is,
even those online programs have plenty of fieldwork and internships and supervised work where you're getting that in-person work. I'm just trying to avoid your spending 3 years of no income and in classes that may, in fact, be more theoretical. I can't tell you how many people who have gone to Ivy League schools for, let's say, medical schools, talk about something that's really practical, and how much they learn that is irrelevant to the day-to-day practice of being great with their patients.
I get that completely. No,
okay.
I see that absolutely. I guess the issue of practicality is foremost on my mind because I started out in art school. That was my first study. So I don't need to go to art school again.
Yeah, there's two kinds of practicality. There is which career is likely to be yield income, and then there's a practicality of instruction. And there are the people who are professors at Berkeley and at Stanford or whatever, their raison d'etre, their mission in life, what they get hired and promoted to do is based on their little narrow area. If they're studying a particular kind of cancer of the thymus gland and they're getting a research grant from the National Institutes of Health, that's going to, if they get that big grant, they're going to get hired, promoted, and tenured. Whereas whether they teach your class well, even if they know very little about the day, they spend relatively little time in clinical practice as a physician, they may not be great at the nuance. I'm speaking with a certain amount of knowledge here because I teach in the medical school at UCSF. And, you know, yes, some of the faculty or, you know, my co-faculty member was a wonderful, he was an emergency room doctor at Kaiser and really had done that for 33 years. But many of the faculty members spend a remarkably little time in practice and they escape from clinical practice so they could do their little narrow research. So I'm just trying to open your mind a little bit to not having to spend 3 years to get, quote, rigor that may be irrelevant rigor. Just a thought. But the broader question, when you tell me you're only 50 and most people who are in decent health at 50, you've got another 20 years of work life. If you're my brother, I don't tell you to consign yourself to 20 more years of court reporting if you think that stinks. No, I am on board with your changing careers, but I'm trying to get you the best of both worlds. I'm trying to get you to make that career change without having to suffer so much. And seeing, I'm not guaranteeing it's possible, I'm merely asking you to do a deeper dive into finding a program that represents the right balance of important rigor and time and money saving. What do you think?
Well, right now I'm regretting having used the word rigor because it does seem like you've zeroed in on that. And I don't know that for me that is really the, that's not the primary issue.
Okay, you want to tell me what the primary issue is?
It's money. It's money. And whether it's an asynchronous online program or it's full-time in-person, the reality is that given the nature of the work, it's going to leave little time for me to get any kind of income.
Well, and again, that's why I was suggesting
my place and change everything. And it seems like it's too big a leap. That does seem like too big a leap.
That's where the online programs are good because you can keep your job and work, do a course or two at night, and not if money is the big problem. That's more the argument. For many of the online programs, because again, online programs can also exist not just locally, they can be based anywhere in the country and you could find one that is a good deal and yet still has enough of the practical stuff that you want.
Yeah.
I don't know. What am I missing? I feel like I'm missing something that, am I missing something?
Well, I'm having a hard time to pinpointing it right now. The issue is that even with an online program, I don't know that I would have the intellectual bandwidth to both continue doing the job that I presently do, which intellectually is gratifying. I mean, it's good work, but it's taxing, and I don't think that I could sustain both staying in my job full time and doing a program,
okay,
whether online or in person.
We've got okay, great. We've got to end this call for now because I wanted to take another call before the show ends.
Yeah.
I invite you when you get off the phone to do two things: to look at the full range of programs and see whether part-time work is possible, whether you can work part-time as a court reporter, even if it's as an independent contractor, and do school part-time. Whether there are programs that are inexpensive in terms of the cost that balance the theoretical with the practical so that you just don't, you know, right now you seem like there's a term called commitment bias, and I feel like you're you're too prematurely committed to a full-time, quitting your job, going all the way, and I'm inviting you to spend a little more time investigating the full range of options. I have to thank you for the call, because all our lines are lighted up, but I tried to do the best I can. Hope that'll give you something to think about.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, so we have time for one more call, probably. Yeah, just one. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi.
Hello.
My name is Deborah.
Hi, Deborah.
I'm trying not to be a helicopter mom.
Okay.
And I have a daughter who's a sophomore, and she's getting a degree in theater, tech, and design.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a couple of contacts for her for this possible summer internship.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, should I be the first point of contact with them, or just have her?
It's a great question. I love it. It depends on the kid. Every one of us is at a different stage in our development. If she right now would just go, or she would procrastinate and not do it, it's not inappropriate at this stage. She's a sophomore for you to make that initial contact. Have her on the other end of the line. You know, if you have two different phones, you make the call, and at the right moment, turn it over to her. This is a growth experience. I don't consider it helicoptery for you to make that initial inquiry if developmentally she's at the stage where that would be appropriate. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Perfect. All right. I want to thank you. Go ahead.
What should she include if she was to do a email contact with them?
What would be ideal would be if she could tell, even though she's just a sophomore, somewhere along the line she's had experiences that would contain what are called transferable skills, where she either demonstrated an ability to design a set or costumes or makeup or tickets or the website or whatever, anything that she's done that might be relevant, and then for her to send an attachment, either a JPEG or an MP4 video or whatever, that at least shows what she does. Even if she's just a beginner, it shows that she's not, that she's got, at least she brings something to the table. That's going to be not critical, but it can be helpful. Does that make sense?
That sounds great. Thank you.
You're welcome. We do have time for one quick call, because I'm always trying to make the most of each moment. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. Quick question. How can I help?
Hello?
Hi. Quick question.
Hi, this is Paula.
Hi, Paula.
Hi. So I actually graduated in 2016 from an architecture program.
Mm-hmm.
I have my master's of architecture.
Yep.
And a minor in graphic design.
Yep.
So I'm pretty new to the profession, but I've always also been very interested in virtual reality, and it is something that we do a little bit as architects. I'm not licensed.
I'm going to interrupt you because our time's up. I want to give you a quick tip. There are so many video games that are built, that are made, I think about all the SimCity games and the Civilization games, that have a tremendous amount of rendering of architectural items that might enable you, and we're going to be working into the virtual, we'll be in the virtual reality, holographic space, etc. Why don't you see if you can get yourself an internship or something working for a game company specifically, or even a film company, a Pixar, trying to develop the architectural renderings for those. I got to go, but I wanted to give you that while I had that few seconds, all right?
Awesome. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot.
I appreciate it.
You're welcome. And that's Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my... I promised that I was going to tell you some of my favorite new tweets about work. That'll have to wait till next week. You, my listeners, are priority one. Anyway, I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening and filling up the lines. Please join me again next Thursday at 7. You can call in for a workover. Plus, NYU Professor of Ethical Leadership, named one of the world's top thinkers by Prospect Magazine, and the author of the new book, The Coddling of the American Mind, Jonathan Haidt. Until then, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.